Sir John Baker Carr, Reel 4. You were going to describe to me your trip out to Basra in the Rangoon.
Well, in mid March 1932, the crew selected to take the aircraft. It was, in fact, a squadron leader who was the captain of it, another newly trained flying boat pilot, and myself, and two mechanics, airmen. We collected the aircraft at the makers at Short Brothers, Rochester, on the Medway, and flew it to Felixstowe, up on the east coast, where there was a flying boat station. There we did some working up trials of the aircraft to make sure that all was well with it before starting our flight out to Basra. On the 31st of March, we left for Plymouth, refueled there, and then flew west of Brest to a lake near Bordeaux. There we refueled again.
You found there that the French pilots, the French airmen, had a rather cavalier attitude to
Ah,
refueling.
it was later when our next hop was to another lake just behind Marseille, and we landed there to refuel, and to my horror, but didn't appear to be to anybody else's, there were French workers right up on top of the wings pouring in petrol from large cans into funnels into our wing tanks while smoking cigarettes the while. This I found utterly horrifying, but I later found that you can in fact stick a cigarette into a bucket of petrol and it'll go out. Well, then from there we went on via Naples, Athens, Alexandretta, which is Syria, and then landed at Lake Habaniya, which is in northern Iraq, and then we flew down from there to Basra, the Persian Gulf, and landed on the Shatt al-Arab River, which is the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates, which come down from the north.
What were your first impressions of the station at Basra when you arrived? What did it consist of?
Well, it's very shack-like. First of all, I mean the place, the environment was just a few date palms, and very dried mud soil. It wasn't even sand; it was just hard soil. You'd made marvelous tennis courts with little trouble at all. And there was nothing to entertain the eye really, and unless you enjoyed feeling that you were in one of the outposts of some sort of empire. It was perhaps romantic from that point of view, but in no other. And the station itself was small and hutted. The only town anywhere near, and that was hardly worthy of the name, was a place called Asher, where it had bazaars. And of course, on the river itself, there were some docks, and British India boats, I think, used to come in there, no great size, bibby line. I don't think that I fell in love with the place at any time.
What was the strength of the RAF station there in terms of men and planes?
Well, if I remember rightly, we had about quite a f I think only about eight, six or eight flying boats, and probably double that number of pilots to give you first and second pilots. Then, of course, you had the administrative staff, that is, equipment, accountant, medical, the padres, and so on. So that in the mess, and no wives were allowed because of the awful climate of the place, and we all lived in the mess. I suppose the mess strength must have been around, say, something like 24.
Were the conditions there universally unpleasant throughout the year as regards
No,
climate?
No, they weren't. No, they were from about June to September. The heat was really awful, and the humidity made it feel much worse. I've got a photograph in my photograph album of a sergeant's mess party in their mess, where the temperature was 120 something, and the relative humidity was about 90. And if you look at in this photograph, you'll see that all of the thin cotton uniforms worn were soaked with sweat, everybody.
Did tempers become a little frayed at this time of
year? Oh, my goodness me. They certainly did. Not so much as between individuals, curiously enough, but it showed itself in strange ways. You'd get a clique in the mess of people who otherwise were very good friends would separate themselves and almost refuse to eat at the same time as another clique. A most peculiar phenomenon. And yet only a few miles away, 15 or 20 miles away in the desert, where the weather was really dry, there was 84 Squadron, which had land planes, of course, and that was always regarded as one of the happiest squadrons in the Air Force.
What were the normal tours of duty for the different ranks in the RAF?
Well, because it was such a bad climate, the tour of duty was limited to 2 years, whereas for other places which were much more civilized, you normally did 3.
What about the airmen?
Well, the airmen, I look back on them with great pity now, because they were stuck really for 2 years away from their wives and families, whereas the officers, well, I think you could get some leave after 1 year, but being separated from your wife and family for a year is pretty much, and I don't think it'd be very acceptable nowadays. For the officers, you could, after 6 months, particularly in the summer, you could get what was called local leave, which of course you had to pay for, to get yourself, say, to Cyprus or Jordan or something like that, where the climate was better, and perhaps meet your wife there, or just have a good time away from that sweltering, sticky heat of Basra.
Did you take any leave?
No, I didn't. I only took leave after I took my annual leave. I came back to England, and that's when I got engaged to my wife, present wife.
What was the role of your flying boat squadron out there?
Well, broadly speaking, it was to maintain the peace. And this, I think, was one of the remarkable examples of the Air Force being used in place of armies and navies, but armies in particular, the Air Force being used to keep the peace over a very large area with very little manpower. And this it did. Iraq, I think, was something like a mandate given to us by the League of Nations. It had, of course, been under Turkish, I think, rule, and when the Turks were finally beaten, somebody had to look after the place and get it going again. So there were land squadrons up at Baghdad, and there was this flying boat squadron down the Persian Gulf, and our function was really to look after, keep law and order down in the Persian Gulf, where there were the Arab Emirates, all run by separate sheikhs. Now, they, as a rule, didn't fight against each other, but occasionally you'd get an upstart who would try to seize some part of an oasis which was important or something of that kind. Before I came, there was a little uprising which was quelled by some very small bombs. I saw some photographs of it, but I had no personal knowledge of it at all. And I think that our main function really was to keep Persia out of the Persian Gulf, which they rather felt ought to be theirs.
What kind of operations did you actually undertake while you were there?
Well, really, it was awfully like the Navy in a way. You showed the flag. We used to fly down the Persian Gulf and land at these various places like Bahrain, Dubai, which has now become pretty well known for oil. Yes, we used to go around to Muscat, which has also become pretty well known as well, and show the flag and show that we could get there quite quickly if anything went wrong.
You actually lived in the flying boat?
Yes, we did.
What kind of comforts did the flying boat provide?
Well, not
you
bad, with? Really. It was not bad. I mean, there was a good deal of space in them and very comfortable bunks, but in the hot weather, we very often used to just sleep out on the wings to keep cool. Great big wings.
What about food?
Oh, food. We did ourselves well. We had a naffy at the station, and we used to stock up, work out what was needed for the length of the trip and how many, what was the number of the crew, what our rate of consumption would be, and so on. And, of course, it was mostly tinned food. We used to have just a little bit of fresh food. Not that there was much fresh food available at any time in Basra, but that was used up. Oh, and we used to take a little bit of ice too, but that, of course, didn't last very long. And then we were on the tin stuff and bottled, I'm glad to say.
Did you find that the Rangoon was a reasonably reliable plane to deal with? I have visions of you stranded somewhere in the Persian Gulf.
I don't think I was ever stranded. One was stranded. If you landed in a rough sea, as I said before, there was a chance of knocking off your wingtip float. They had to have these. A wave could damage that. And if the wingtip float was knocked off or lost its buoyancy, then there was almost immediate danger of the aircraft gradually settling over and turning upside down in the water, because there was nothing to hold that side of the wing up. And if it did happen, then you used to get the crew to rush out and all get out onto the other wing where the wingtip float was still buoyant and stay there until you could get some sort of repair or get something underneath the wing which was no longer buoyant.
Did that happen to you?
No, it didn't, I'm glad to say.
Were there any particular problems created by the climate towards the in with regard to the mechanical efficiency of the plane?
I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think so. It really is remarkable how in the frightful humidity, and especially down in the Persian Gulf, during the night, there used to be a condensation of this humidity as the temperature dropped a bit, and there would be thick, sticky fogs. And it always surprised me that you could start the engines at all in the morning. They had to be done, of course, by the airmen, actually two airmen cranking handles on each of the three engines. As for the aeroplanes itself, it had quite a good performance in range, but we never flew much above 1,000 feet. And the detractors of its performance always used to say but its flying speed was much the same as its stalling speed, about 75 miles an hour.
What was the duration of the kind of expeditions that you used to undertake in these?
Do you mean total duration, from time of leaving base to coming back?
Yes, how long, yes.
Oh, very often we'd be away for a week or more. Oh, very often.
This was probably something of a relief to be away from Basra for a week, was it?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
While you were at Basra, your initial four-year commission was shortly to come to an end. Mm. What factors then influenced you in your decision about your future at that stage?
Well, as I was getting into my last year, I had a letter from, I think what was then Imperial Airways, saying we hear from the Air Ministry that as a qualified flying boat pilot, you'll be ending your service in the RAF in the near future, and we should be glad to consider employing you if you'd like. Well, I decided I didn't really want to do that. I mean, that would have been a very short-term thing with not much future, because in actual fact, of course, flying boats, in fact, didn't last awfully long in the Imperial Airways after that. I think the last were... the Sunderlands, I think, were RAF ones. But at any rate, that sort of thing, they didn't last very long.
Did you realise at the time that they were going to be
No,
short-lived?
I didn't. No, I'd like to stay in the Air Force and make a career and not do anything so specialised as to stick to one aeroplane. So at that time, there was an annual competitive examination for people who wanted to get a permanent commission in the Air Force. And remembering that in that time they were cutting down what was already a pretty small Air Force, and there was less and less money available from the government to maintain any size. And so the numbers of officers required was not very great. I think the total annual requirement for short service officers to become permanent was something like 64. At any rate, no, 64 took the examination, as far as I remember, in my time, but they actually took far less than that. And I believe, if I remember correctly, there were about 14 vacancies. You had to specialize after you take this competitive examination, which was which you'd say was a science one very largely. I mean, physics, maths, structures, and then some things like navigation, some aircraft things, and Air Force law, and so on. But you had to specialise when you got a permanent commission, when you'd been successful, and before you took the examination, you were invited to say from a list what specialization you would like to study. Were you successful? And they were, if I remember rightly, navigation, engineering, photography, armament. I think those are the only ones I can remember. There might have been another. Oh, signals. Well, I put down for navigation because I thought it would keep in the air more than the other things. And I didn't really want to do the engineering one because that, although it was a magnificent course, it lasted 2 whole years. I think it was 2, it might have even been more. And you certainly came out of it a jolly fine engineer. But I wanted really to stay in the air as far as possible. The idea was that every pilot had to specialise sometime in his career in one of those things, or as a flying instructor. And then he did, say, 2 or 3 years on flying, then he did a year in his specialization, and then back to flying or whatever the next thing was as he rose in rank.
You, in fact, had to have 2 goes at the examination.
I had to have 2 goes. The first one, I came down with malaria in the middle of it. And I had to be more or less carted out. And the Air Ministry very kindly let me take it again. And I was successful to the extent, I think, of coming out about 14th in 14 vacancies for that particular examination.
So this was probably why you didn't get your choice.
That's right.
Navigation.
They put me onto armament. Well, I didn't really want to do armament, but still I was most grateful to get a permanent commission and set about doing my best as an armourer.
Round about this time, to digress a bit, you got married in England when you came back to England. What was the reaction of your superiors to that?
Well, they took a dim view, really, because for one thing, I was on the armament course and they didn't really want their pupils to be interrupted by the cares of marriage in the middle of it. That was one thing. The other was that I was then 27 years old, which was 3 years below the statutory 30 for getting married and having to support a wife with no marriage allowance. And so my very kind station commander tried to dissuade me from this, but like most chaps who in love, nothing really would dissuade you.
Can you remember actually how much you were paid at that time in the RAF?
I can't, but I can remember very roughly that when my wife and I were first married, I think we lived on about 500 a year. And at the end of the month, of course, we were frightfully nervous about cashing checks in case one bounced and I was thrown out. And in those days, we also got ration allowance and I can't remember what other small allowances. And at the end of the month, we used to telephone to the station accountant officer and ask him whether he'd put them into our banks yet or not so we could cash a check.
Anyway, when you obtained your permanent commission, you returned to England in at the beginning of 1934, and you were sent to the armament specialist course at the
Eastchurch
Air Armament School at Eastchurch. Mm. What did that course consist of?
It consisted of learning all about the mechanisms of the guns in use. That was the Lewis gun. And, God, I haven't got my name in. Turn it off the moment. Yes, we studied the mechanisms of the guns in use in the RAF, which were the Lewis gun, which was the free swinging gun used in the backs of bombers, and the Vickers gun, which was the fixed one, which was used in fighter aircraft. We learned about bombs and their fuse mechanisms, and of course most people don't realize that a bomb is nothing without a fairly elaborate fuse, because if you drop a bomb on a target, say like a building, and you want to blow it up, it's no good the bomb going off as soon as it touches the building on the top. It's got to get right down inside before the bomb is detonated in order to have the maximum effect. Or also, if it's too late, it'll go right into the ground and do very little damage other than the foundations, perhaps, of the building. So fuses was a thing we learned quite a lot about. So that was guns, bombs, fuses, small arms, rifles, pistols, and so on. Well, then there was a great deal of classroom training, stripping these mechanisms, as well as the purely theoretical learning about them. But there was also using them in the air. We did bombing practice on the bombing range, and also air gunnery practice, of course, which is a repetition of what I'd done before.
Tell me about the bombing practice. Whereabouts was the bombing range that you used to
do? The bombing range was, I think, at a place called Laysdown on an estuary just at the edge of Eastchurch. Is very nearly, it was on the Isle of Sheppey. On the Isle of Sheppey, and it was, I can't remember the name of the river between that and the Isle of Sheppey and the mainland over on the east side, but the Laysdown Range, I think, were there, and they had targets which I think were floated on the water, in fact. And we used to go over and drop bombs. It was my first introduction, really, to a bomb site, which is a fairly crude one by present-day standards. And we used to drop practice bombs, which when they hit the surface, blew off a puff of smoke. Those smoke bombs, they were about the equivalent of about 20 pound weight. And that gave one fairly amount of practice in using a bomb sight and also steering the aircraft over the target accurately and pressing the button at the right time.
Did you actually... This was, as it were, aiming the bomb. Did you actually consider the utility of different kinds of bombs against different kinds of targets?
Well, this was certainly part of the training, but our range of bombs then was very small, very small. I don't think a great deal of progress had been made since the end of World War One, almost. I mean, they were anti-personnel bombs for attacking enemy troops and machine gun positions and that sort of thing, possibly from a marine point of view, attacking small ships. And then there were the one or two bigger bombs, but I don't think much over 1,000 pounds, if that, in those days. And the fuses we had were extremely unsophisticated as compared to what they became in this last war.
Did you spend most of your time at East Church, or did you visit any other establishments that dealt in armaments at that particular stage?
I can't remember visiting any other establishment. I don't think there was any need to, because East Church was equipped with everything that was thought necessary at that time to provide one with a fairly comprehensive knowledge of weapons and their use at those times.
How many people were there on the course any one year?
I should guess there was something like between 12 and 14. I should say, there was something between 12 and 14. And they weren't all young chaps by any means. There were one or two more elderly.